So that study that you just saw was part of a larger study, essentially what we call the Crime Prevention Initiative in Louisiana. This was from the Bureau of Justice Assistance and CSG, so the Council for State Governance. All right, same family. Thank you very much. Now, why did we start this study? Essentially, what we were finding was that New Orleans is the murder capital. We fight. Who do we fight with all the time for a murder capital? D.C., Detroit. Wow, so many. Isn't that just terrible? Chicago, right? With Baltimore. Ooh, Baltimore. St. Louis. We fight. We duke it out for murder capital of the world. Not something that any of us should be really proud of. So what we find is that we're having too many recidivists committing our crimes and our violent crimes. And essentially, every time you see somebody on the news, you find there's huge rap, you know, this file a mile long on this one person. And it would make the average citizen, well, why don't we just lock these guys up? And what I feel and what I think some of us are seeing is that there are a lot of untreated issues in this population. You let them out, but there's no support for what they need. So what the CPI project was essentially trying to do was restructure probation and parole and then wrap around these guys some social services. How am I on time? Okay. So first strategy, we're identifying the highest risk offenders. And we're testing them, one of those tests you just saw. And we're looking again. This is that same group. They had a drug, gun, or COV charge, any combination of it, and some of them had gang affiliation. We want to train probation and parole officers to be more case management oriented. They want to speak to the person. How is a, what's a, the average parole officer like? And I hope I don't offend anybody, but sometimes they can be a little militaristic, a little wannabe copish, right? Right? So when you find that that's the main attitude of your PO, that's not going to help you. That's somebody who's trying to bust you and put you back into jail, right? And that's not a supportive role. So what we wanted to do was train those POs to be more supportive, more case management oriented, but not turn them into social workers. We wanted to change how often the PO sees the client. So right now in New Orleans, it's one PO to 180 clients. Ooh, that's excellent coverage, right? I'm really going to be able to help you get a job, right? So what we wanted to do was switch that from 1 to 50. So each CPI officer had 50 clients. And then we wanted to wrap around social services and say, okay, you not only see your PO this much more often, but you see someone who's going to backstop your child support, who's going to help you deal with getting a job. You can barely, you know, read or write, but you're supposed to fill out a resume and be pro-social in a new environment like that, right? So we have people to kind of backstop that process, and this is the criteria we just spoke about. We had some assumptions. I'll kind of skip through this, but some of them were essentially, the point here is you need to, if you're going to do a program, understand and be clear about your assumptions. I think that if I give you this program, somehow magically you're going to be better. And you need to be honest. Are your assumptions culturally appropriate? Are they economically appropriate? So these are things that we had to deal with. Now, don't try this at home without the buy-in of your jail. So DPSNC, the Department of Public Safety and Corrections, high leadership there. We had the mayor on board. We had both NOPD and Baton Rouge PD on board. We had all of probation and parole on board. We could not have done that. And me being Tulane and Dr. Sharp being Tulane, being able to evaluate this, we could not have done that without that level of buy-in. So it's very difficult. And really, essentially, I want to just talk about some of the theory behind how we believe this would work. We believe that we were enhancing protective factors and decreasing risk factors. So this is some of the process and how we thought we were going to get through to this. And I may come back to this if we have more time, but I think you guys should think about how you know the risk in your group plays out. So low-risk people, likely not to recidivate. High-risk people, high likelihood to recidivate, and who are you grabbing? And is your intervention really going to change their behavior, or is it going to just deter it? So here we're having this conversation about synthetic marijuana. This is a behavior. The behavior change, no behavior change there. It's just the substance that's changed. Now, before I show you the outcomes, we had to deal with one of the big issues, was that by increasing my surveillance, literally from one time every 3 months to three times a month, from a PI who now has, instead of 180 cases, you and 40 other folks, what do you think I'm going to find? I'm going to find every bag of weed. I'm going to find every gun you got hidden under the bed. I'm going to find everything that you do wrong. So is that going to deter revocation and recidivism? Probably not. I'm probably going to lock your ass back up again. So what you find is this approach, this social work approach from the PI and wraparound services, is that a long-term strategy? And then this supervision short-term strategy. And how are those going to interact with my outcomes? This is really essentially the breakdown. We had 1,150 guys and women that we were following. We had controls at several levels. And because we picked people from high and low risk areas with, high and low shooting crime murder areas. That's essentially what we stratified on. But the crime also followed. I did some propensity score matching to make sure that our group were matched in terms of their criminal histories and the list that you see right there. Now, this is just showing you how we implemented. So the number, the average number of PO contacts per person was 20 versus 6, right? So high detection, high visibility, high interaction. Our wraparound services, we had about 180 people move through that versus about 600 who did not. And we had a good number of people getting a high dosage. We had some at low dosage, but we had more at a higher dosage. And then how many numbers of programs were they attending? We had good, more than 50% at high dosage. All right, outcomes. I'm going to try to move through this really quickly so we can get to what any of this means. Now, if you look at the arrested, not revoked, there was about 47%, 50%. But how many arrested, and then how many arrested and revoked? So you're about 18 arrested and revoked. So many people get arrested in New Orleans. So many people. So is arrest I want you to ask yourselves, is arrest a true indicator of criminogenic behavior? Yes? No? You are being arrested, by the way. Okay. And then what were they arrested for? We may not have time to go through this, but this is the salient points here I want to show are this is violations. And essentially what we see is that our POs were able to look at our group and use more violations for probation and parole as opposed to throwing them back into jail. So violations are good. And if you look at every other, so the first would be control, first bar control, second treatment. The first one is gangs in Baton Rouge. So first bar is control in the second segment, and then treatment. And these are our non-gang groups. And then the same for New Orleans. First bar is control, and second bar is treatment, but this is for our gang. And then the last one is our not gang group. And we had more in the not gang groups. So you see that higher strata of using 1, 2, 3, 4 violations as opposed to maybe just throwing those guys back into jail. That is a win. Violating you, maybe even having a short-term jail sentence, but not revoking, that's actually a good sign. Again, I was telling you that incarcerated from each of these groups, control versus treatment and gang versus non-gang, you'll find that the difference in incarceration didn't change. So all of this behavior, all of this work really didn't change how much people were being arrested. It may have changed how much time you spent in jail. Now the idea here was to catch you with the small thing first and put you in jail and try to straighten you up with the small thing before the big thing. And the big thing would be the murder, the armed burglary, armed robbery, so on and so forth. Here we're looking at revocations, and we had a significant difference in revocations. Unfortunately, not really in the direction that we wanted to. Our treatment group was revoked more often. So this idea that maybe our guys are not just victims of the system, you have to do a little bit to get revoked. And when we watched them more, what we found was more crime. How are we going to deal with that? Family, what are we going to do? I mean, these are very intriguing questions. There's a lot going on here. And then also looking at the mean days incarcerated, which essentially, I was looking at intensity of incarceration. You're getting multiple arrests and a lot of time in jail. So you could get arrested for something small, short time in jail, right? But you could get several arrests, and that last crime be the big crime that puts you in. So the final analysis with this group, what were the number of PO contacts actually had a significant impact on decreasing arrests and arrest intensity. What I was saying, the number of arrests dividing into the days you were incarcerated. The number of PO referrals had a significant impact on decreasing arrests. So this idea that the probation officer is there and they can provide a service, is that service appropriate and is it done well? And if you have a strong intensity of it, it might have a positive effect. Wraparound services were most effective in groups already employed. And a group already employed is what? They're already low risk. So it may have been that the wraparound services, the dosage wasn't high enough. The level that those people could help wasn't strong enough, or some of the psychosocial needs were too deep, that having somebody take care of them for a small period of time was not enough to really help you get out. And intense wraparound services were not effective at showing a reduction in arrests. And the longer time in wraparound services, however, was associated with a decrease in revocations. So not necessarily an arrest, but the idea that you were put back in jail for a very long time, it essentially means just what we're saying. Our problems are not short, easy, fixable problems. They're deep in our community. They're institutionalized. They have a lot to do with access to employment and a bunch of other things that are essentially societal and need to be handled at a society level. Okay? I think that is it. I'm going to leave this so open for questions. I just want to make this point. I'm leaving the slide open for the question segment. This is lead. This is the concentration of lead in New Orleans. And I want to invite us to think about this from a neurobiological standpoint, from a trauma standpoint. This is a complex situation. We will not fix this with one program, one idea, one concept. We have so many issues to conquer. All right.
Dr. Singh actually saved us some time, so we actually have about 10 minutes for Q&A. So I know there were two people that I did not get to. One was my colleague here from Chicago, so you can ask. Yeah, I know Selena. Selena, would you like to ask? All right, she wants to take a picture first.
So many African American young men, Latino men that are locked up as you know, the long terms of that, of legalizing it, while it may solve one problem, it's going to create other problems. And I would certainly like to engage in another conversation about this after that. But if you could elaborate on this.
No, I think that you make very valid points. One of the things that we want to evaluate is whether in cities such as Denver and Seattle, where there has been legalization, whether synthetic marijuana use has decreased. We don't know that yet. And that would be a good way of kind of evaluating whether the uses, the legalization is actually affecting the use in, of synthetic marijuana. So we don't know that. But I do agree with you that synthetic marijuana use, particularly in regards to violent injury, and the amount of violence that may be occurring on the street is actually maybe increasing it. We don't know that primarily because we're not able to test the number of people who are in the criminal justice system who have used it and that may have engaged in a violent crime. So we don't know whether violent offenders or not are using it and whether it was even tied to the violent event. And we don't know that for also for patients who have been treated by an ED for a violent injury. But we are getting that at self-report. So this is a huge issue. Clearly, marijuana, the legalization of marijuana is a huge issue, and I think as we're talking about the legalization of marijuana, we have to include synthetic, and I haven't heard any of that yet in this discussion of the legalization of marijuana and what the effects are regarding synthetic. And I do agree with you, and Dr. St. Ville and I were having this discussion the other day regarding the dispensaries. So now that you're legalizing the guys that are actually selling marijuana, right, they have to compete with the price on the street,
exactly.
Right? And is that going to move other people to begin smoking? We have data in our study that people are already producing synthetic marijuana in their homes, right? And they're packaging
so
it.
My question, like, are we looking for where this is being produced? I mean, in the legal system, so we know that this is out there. Are we trying to find the root of it? Are we trying to figure out where does this come from?
Well, much of it comes from China, right? So it comes in a powder form and it's liquefied. And the Schedule One for synthetic marijuana, the ban, they're never able to keep up with the chemicals because a new chemical compound comes on the market, I think, roughly every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. So the leader from China's got to come in about 4.1.
Right.
Oh, okay.
But also understand that the sanctioning for marijuana, like, so you have people that are taking synthetic who are not a criminal drug. They're looking for a
right.
job. You got people in the military. So it's anybody who's subject to your analysis, period.
But
there's a mental component to that. You got to be crazy.
You got to get a job.
Right.
And you got to still get high.
But the other part is the collateral effect. So if you just take into the concept of million-dollar blocks, right, and if you think about million-dollar blocks in certain zip codes, the census tracts, they have a high proportionate number of people who are under criminal justice supervision. Even if you're not under criminal justice supervision, and the majority of people in your neighborhood are, that may become a normative behavior in your community to just smoke it, even if you aren't under, even if you're not on papers, right? So we have anecdotal data which has indicated, suggested to us that we have young people in D.C. who are smoking it all the time who are not under, recreationally, not under juvenile justice supervision.
Like, that's just a thing.
It's just become common. And if we think about much of D.C. and the black neighborhoods being under a prison state, you can see how that you can make that connection.
All right, we want to ask two more questions here. And these are very complex issues. Actually, I'm going to try to get three in. We have about 5 minutes. Then I'll see some of them.
Yeah.
And I also want to say the colleague from Chicago is actually Selena Smith, Blackhawks Health Workers, immediate past president. So I just want to acknowledge that. Someone back here had their hand up. Yes, ma'am. Afterwards, if you would do that as soon as I close the session here, I'm reserved this last question. Hopefully, it's a question for our panelists.
It's a question that's shaped as a statement that you
can do. Let me say this before you ask the question. The presenters, I think, have all said that they will remain for some Q&A. However, there will be another presentation starting 30 minutes after this one in this room.